Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you on the program today, listening and hopefully learning about things that are important in our state. We have a great lineup for you. As always, Representative Nelson Dollar will be stopping by. We'll be talking about the amazing impact of tax reforms and unemployment reforms in North Carolina. And also, we'll be talking about why expanding Medicaid really doesn't make a lot of sense at this point here in North Carolina. Also, our good friend Nick Oxner from WBTV in Charlotte will be joining us, talking about the things that he's been delving into. And, of course, Dr. Bob Lipke, education policy analyst at the Civitas Institute. I ran across a headline that was very disturbing about how, well, only one high school in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system has a majority of students that are ready to go to college based on recent ACT test scores. And so Bob and I will kick that around a little bit. It's a frustrating topic and one that never seems to go away here in North Carolina. How our schools take kids, you know, they're in school, they start out in typically a pre-K program, and they go through elementary school, middle school, high school, and all of a sudden, oh, they're not ready for college. Well, they can't read at grade level. My goodness, what in the world? By the way, that $8 billion that the General Assembly has appropriated to K through 12 public schools, it's just not enough. You know, we need more money. Well, you said that when it was $7 billion, and you'll probably say it next year, you know, if it's $9 or $10 billion, who knows? The bottom line is money is not the answer. It doesn't seem to be. When you look at these things really through the lens of nonpartisanship and just plain old common sense, something is not right in the education delivery system here in North Carolina. Now, the weird part about all of this is that, yep, there are kids going to school at Chapel Hill and at State and Elon and App and Wake Forest and Duke. So kids are getting into college. But these reports that we see more and more frequently that kids are not ready for college kind of makes you wonder and scratch your head how they're getting in. And maybe they're getting better in their senior year and being more prepared. Maybe their SAT scores are better. Maybe their overall body of work is better. You know, testing is not always the most accurate way to gauge student performance or student knowledge or student education. That being said, something is wrong with the education system here in North Carolina. And, you know, it was Common Core is going to change the world. I remember, like it was yesterday, sitting when I worked for Senator Tillman in an education, higher education meeting during one of the interims there, probably 4 years ago now. And I remember them just being giddy, these people who were making presentations about Common Core. And the legislators there were, you know, equally as enthusiastic. Common Core is going to help. Common Core is the answer. And, well, we got 2 years into Common Core, or maybe even less, and, boy, the roof just came off on how horrible that was in the minds of many parents and many educators. And if you've ever seen some of the math problems in Common Core, well, let's just put it this way. I don't get it. Now, there are some people who have scolded me and said, oh, Mark, you know, this is just a better way of thinking. But when you put a problem on a piece of paper and tell a kid to solve, you know, what is 95 minus 80, and we've all learned how to do that quickly, and the answer obviously being 15, well, you look at Common Core and there's like an 8-page, you know, schematic. And I'm thinking, why? That is just not necessary. And parents in droves rebelled against Common Core, not only in North Carolina, but nationwide. And it was very interesting because Senator Tillman had a bill that clearly said that the enactment of that legislation repealed the statute which established Common Core here in North Carolina. And yet, it's still here. And my point is that when you get headlines like the Charlotte Observer had, only one CMS high school has a majority ready for college, it's obvious it's not Common Core that's getting them ready for college, and it's not Race to the Top or any of this other stuff. So we'll talk with Dr. Bob Lipke about what's the answer? How do we fix this? By the way, out of 99,100 North Carolina juniors that took the ACT, this article reports that 15.4% had college-ready scores. Isn't that nice? $8 billion, $8 billion, K-12, and 15.4% college-ready scores on the ACT. You know, you just have to stand back and go, this is just weird. This doesn't make any sense. And there's a lot that goes into education. I understand that. Teachers and parents, administrators, the demographics of children, whether or not they come from a upper class or middle class or lower middle class or poverty areas. All of that goes into what makes up how a school and how individual students perform on tests. I get all of that. But I don't think anybody who's rational and who's not partisan would disagree that we can do better in North Carolina. And that's my point. We're spending an awful lot of money, taxpayer money, and I don't think we're getting the return on that investment that we could be getting on education here in North Carolina. Well, against my better judgment, I stayed up to the very end and watched last night's debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And I say against my better judgment because just me personally listening to her is a challenge. And so my initial thought, and some people disagreed with me on social media, but I really thought that Mr. Wallace, the moderator, was just letting her drone on and ramble on and essentially make speeches and would quickly cut Donald Trump off. And it seemed like every time I turned around, she was just yammering on about something. So people said, no, you know, Mr. Wallace is being fair. Well, I saw a report that she actually had 41 minutes and change in talking time, and apparently he had 35. So her time was longer than his, maybe not as significantly as I thought, but she definitely got to say more. Whether or not she said anything worth remembering is questionable. But did you watch the debate? Let us know who you thought won at What Matters NC on Twitter, at What Matters NC. It was a tough debate to watch because everything I expected from Trump sort of didn't happen from a demeanor standpoint. I mean, in fact, when he first started out, I thought, my goodness, you know, get this guy a latte. But anyway, we'll be talking more about the debate as we move forward. And so glad to have you listening to our program. Hope that you will enjoy this edition of What Matters in North Carolina. It's always a pleasure to welcome to What Matters in North Carolina, Representative Nelson Dollar. He is one of the chief budget writers in the North Carolina House. And Representative Dollar, welcome to What Matters in North Carolina.
Oh, good to talk with you, Mark.
The reason I wanted to have you on the program today is we've been following for the last couple of weeks a couple of things. Number one, the Civitas Institute released a tax study that was done by some folks at High Point University, which shows that the tax reforms and the unemployment reforms that the General Assembly made, and by the way, you were a part of much of that, certainly, and your role as one of the chief budget writers in the House, that those reforms, Representative Dollar, have really led to better jobs, better incomes for the people of North Carolina.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that the growth, for example, in median household income in North Carolina which has gone up very strongly, certainly far better than the national average, is, again, another indicator. The fact that we've dropped the unemployment rate over the last 4 years in half of what it was, you know, when, for example, when Governor McCrory took office. And I think that's an indication, you know, once we got, you know, it's true there was a recovery underway, but once our tax reforms really began to take hold, and in many respects, business just reacting to seeing what was going on in North Carolina and decisions that were being made that were in the pipeline to be made, folks clearly saw that it was going to be to their advantage long term to locate in North Carolina or to do their expansion. And that has, you know, fueled a real, I guess the governor calls it a comeback, but certainly a real renaissance, and given far more momentum to North Carolina's economic recovery than in a number of other states.
Our guest is Representative Nelson Dollar here. He's representing the fine folks in Wake County in the Cary area in North Carolina, and we're appreciating his time this morning as we talk about the recent tax study that the Civitas Institute released that was done by some folks at High Point University, showing that tax reforms, unemployment insurance reforms here in North Carolina have done a remarkable job in helping the economy. The economy is surging in North Carolina. But I want to take you back, Representative Dollar, and you've been down serving in the House for a few years now. I'd like to know, and I think our listeners would appreciate, what it was like in January of 2011 when the Republicans were in the majority in the House and in the Senate, and suddenly you walk in and, you know, you should have been able to really bask in the excitement, but you're staring a nearly $3 billion budget deficit in the face. That had to be kind of daunting and kind of a big downer, don't you think?
It was a tremendous challenge once Republicans won control, even in the late fall, early winter of 2010. We had members of the Purdue administration, I'm not sure that they talked to her about it, but they were coming to us talking about problems that they had, budget issues that they had. There were clearly significant budget issues, for example, in Medicaid and in a range of other areas, that as we began to get into 2011 and try to address that whole range of issues, you're right, Mark, the mountain was much higher than what we thought. There were more problems there than what we thought, and a lot more problems off book, which many of us didn't think was even possible at the state level. There were things that were not even showing up on the normal state government paperwork that were owed that we had to address.
Wow. Well, take me through the process now. There you are. It's 2011. You're facing the challenges that you just described. Did you come up in the middle of the night and think, hey, let's cut taxes, that'll work? Or I'm sure it wasn't that simple, but the normal human reaction, I think, Representative Dollar, would have been to say, by golly, we need revenue. We've got to raise taxes. And lo and behold, you guys didn't do that. You, in fact, stopped the penny sales tax, which put $1 billion back into North Carolina families' hands. And you went about the task of cutting taxes. And quite remarkably, not only were able to balance the budget, but here we are with a surplus, a lot of money in the rainy day fund, which we need now. And how did you come to the conclusion, facing all of the difficulty you were facing, that cutting taxes and making the kind of reforms that you did was the best way to go?
Well, I think the way we looked at it, we made those promises in the 2010 elections. We won a huge majority. It was very much unexpected. And we knew coming in that if we did not stick to our principles, stick to the plan that we had laid out for voters all across the state, that there would be a price paid for that. The voters had said very strongly they wanted the temporary taxes done away with. That was hurting, as you said, working people and all sorts of folks in our state, seniors on fixed incomes. And they said that they wanted us to balance the budget just like they did in their families, and just like they had to tighten their belts in the Great Recession, the state was going to have to tighten its belt. And that's really what we did. And I think that that the House and the Senate came together in that budget. That was a budget that was done probably as quickly as about any budget I've ever seen done. Everyone knew what their targets were, that we were going to have to set priorities. And it was truly about setting priorities, saying, okay, what is most important? And let's truly fund that first. And let's dive in and let's find those savings. And we've had a number of members who have been around a while and, brought that experience, brought a lot of their recommendations to the table, things that we've been looking at for years that we wanted to do, that we felt, where we felt we could save money. And of course, we actually ended up having some conservative Democrat support that year as well to override the governor's veto. Governor Perdue still wanted to raise taxes, and we just said no.
Well, I'm glad. As a citizen, I'd like to say thank you. So you guys made the decision down there to, as you say, create spending targets and implement tax reforms. And have you personally been surprised at how quickly not only the state was able to rebound, which, by the way, I think some on the left would like to say, oh, well, the whole country's rebounding, but I don't think that a national rebound is to, be given the credit for the remarkable way that our state has responded to the leadership that you have provided. And so are you a little surprised, though, at how well things have gone so quickly?
Well, I can certainly say I'm very pleased with it. This was what we were hoping for when we went down the path of saying we're going to hold to our promises. We're going to allow those temporary taxes to go away, which pumped an immediate $1 billion back into the economy. When we said we're going to work on tax reform, and we really weren't able to get to the meat of tax reform until 2013 because we couldn't get much past Perdue. But being able to hold the line and getting in and working on starting the work on reforms for the unemployment insurance issue, which we addressed. We addressed tort reform in that first session, a great deal of regulatory and business reforms. I think all of those issues that we addressed, not just working on the tax side or on the appropriation side, helped send that signal out there all across the country that North Carolina was open for business again.
Yeah.
That we were moving in to attack tax reform, as I say, which we got to the biggest piece of that done in 2013, that businesses could come, capital investment was welcome, and, we were going to do everything we could at the state level to accelerate a recovery nationally that is still very sluggish.
Yeah.
And so, I think, Mark, as you were saying, we have far outperformed the national average. We had one of the highest unemployment rates in the country when we first came into office, and now our unemployment is significantly below the national average.
Yeah, that's really amazing. And I don't think that people are really getting the message the way that they should be all across our state. I saw a Civitas poll yesterday they had released that kind of indicates that, that people broadly don't know that the state is doing as well as it's doing from an economic standpoint. So I'm hoping that by talking to people like yourself who has helped to guide the state into a place of great economic resurgence and progress, that the word will get out. I want to shift gears just momentarily because I had a thought that you are also involved very much in the whole issue of Medicaid in North Carolina. And this might be a dumb question. And so if it is, you can say, Mark, that's a dumb question. But as we've seen Representative Dollar, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, talking last year, 30% rate increase, this year projecting 24.7 for plans in the individual part of the Affordable Care Act. So you have these gigantic rate increases on the one hand. On the other hand, you have people on the left saying, well, we need to expand Medicaid and all of that. But when I look at how the Affordable Care Act has really harmed families, particularly financially, is it fair to say that would really not be a good idea, expanding Medicaid in North Carolina and getting more involved with things that the federal government has to offer, since so far it hasn't worked very well? Am I making a fair statement, or are the two just totally unconnected?
No, I think you are making a fair statement. I think that it's as Republicans have been saying, there are some, there are some good aspects of Obamacare that what we need to do is repeal and replace. There are a few pieces in there that we would certainly pick up on. Some of those are pieces that the Heritage Foundation and others had talked about for some time. But the bigger framework of Obamacare is fundamentally flawed, and you can see that, as you pointed out, Mark, with the rates that are in the exchanges. Those rates have gone up each year. Everyone knows that they're going to go up again next year. You know, even with subsidies, you're pricing so many people out of the market. The way Obamacare is structured, it's not pulling in a balanced risk pool. So, the insurers, it's costing them, frankly, more money than what the program was designed to cost. You know, they're trying to force people of all ages and stations into a healthcare system that, you know, frankly, a lot of younger people are not interested in being in right now. That's, you know, a lot of us that went through those years, remember that. We certainly want everybody covered. That is the ideal for us to do. But the way they constructed this in Obamacare is, frankly, simply not working. And we need a program that is going to be financially sound, which Obamacare and the exchanges are not. And there's no choices there. You know, North Carolina, just like a number of other states, are down to one insurer that's in the exchange.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not my, I mean, it's almost like, why have an exchange if there's only one, you know, product, or there's only one company that's offering, you know, whatever the level, you know, gold, silver, bronze, you know, the various levels of the program. I mean, it's there's no point in an exchange if there's very little to exchange.
Exactly. So one last question as we talk about these things, Representative Dollar. I want to go back to the economy. And you guys, yourself as chief budget writer in the House, your colleagues in the Senate, had the foresight to put money aside in the state's rainy day fund, is what we'll call it. And there's over $1 billion in there now. And Attorney General Cooper was on record in a couple of different print mediums before the first debate that he and Governor McCrory had, criticizing that and you know, bringing out the tired, we could have used this money for education, that mantra from the left. But he's been proven to really have been off base because, as you know, Hurricane Matthew has devastated a great part of our state. Now, you guys did a good job putting that money aside, and I think that was very, very prudent. And I really think that that prudence, when compared with statements that the Attorney General made, that was not a good thing to do. I think that really shows a clear distinction between the ideology of conservatism and the, you know, the spend it all ideology of liberalism.
And I think what the Attorney General is missing, what Cooper is missing, is that money in the rainy day fund is not recurring money. So you could not use those funds, for example, to raise teacher pay or to provide, you know, expand Medicaid or, you know, to buy into more Obamacare. You couldn't use those funds for those purposes anyway. It's one-time money. That's the kind of money that goes into the rainy day fund, the savings reserve. So there's two things that are wrong about his statements. One is he's mischaracterizing how you could even use the money. And more to your point, had we taken that approach, the approach that was taken, for example, the last time when, you know, when Floyd came through, they only had around $300 million, give or take, in their rainy day fund at that time, and they had to pull from all sorts of different programs and sources and funds to be able to address Floyd. This year, with the, you know, the tragedy that we've seen and the natural disaster that we've had with Matthew, as we work through the cleanup and we work through addressing so many needs that so many people have, the good thing is we have all the money right there in the savings reserve to cover the state's portion of those expenses and to help fill in the gaps and, you know, whether it's addressing roads, whether it's addressing housing, food, clothing, shelter. There are certainly a lot of gaps, and it will be expensive for our state. But as you said, it's a good thing that Republicans were in charge and believe in saving money because we have it.
Absolutely. I think that this is a clear real-life example of that statement. And I'm just looking at an article today that was published, the Carolina Journal, back in August of 2016, and thought I'd leave you on this note, Representative Dollar. The left is misleading about North Carolina's Carolina comeback. The state has outperformed the Southeast and the nation in gross domestic product, employment, and our after-tax per-person incomes have gone up about 10% faster than national and regional averages. All I can say to that is, Representative Dollar, you guys are doing a great job, and we as citizens of our state certainly appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Mark, and I really believe those numbers are exactly the result of good conservative Republican policies. That's what we want for our state, to be in a great situation financially as far as the state is concerned, to be responsible with tax dollars, and to focus on jobs and the economy. And we have truly focused on jobs and the economy, and we're going to continue to do that in the future.
Well, thank you very much, sir. Thank you for being our guest, as always, here on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thank you, Mark. Always a pleasure.
All right. It's always our pleasure to welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina, Nick Oxner. He is the investigative reporter for WBTV in Charlotte. Nick, welcome back.
Hello.
So you've been busy, obviously, with a lot of things going on across the state. Originally, you were looking at some of the flooding that was going on down east. I suppose some of your colleagues are still keeping an eye on that.
Yeah, we still have people. I think some of my colleagues were down in Lumberton still this week. We had folks pretty much every day down there last week. We continue to hear not only are we sending folks down there, but we continue to hear from families that, you know, have been displaced from Lumberton and maybe with folks in Charlotte. And I think it's a good reminder that, you know, this storm is going to have a long-lasting impact, and it impacts not just the people right there down east, but also, you know, people throughout the state are having to go, you know, with loved ones and relatives or seek shelter in a hotel and what have you while their homes are repaired.
While we're on the topic of Hurricane Matthew, let's pivot over to the debate. I'm sure you watched that a couple of nights ago. I wrote that I was surprised that I felt like the Attorney General didn't really up his game a little bit, because I felt like in the first one he wasn't as prepared. But on the other side, I felt like Governor McCrory had just an unusual air of confidence about him, which may be because he's been having to be so involved in the management of the aftermath of this storm.
Well, I'd say that it's probably the case, you know, and McCrory's certainly been very much out front and very visible leading the response to this. Of course, you know, just yesterday he announced the creation of the Hurricane Matthew Committee, Response Committee. He's been down touring disaster areas. He's been holding, you know, near daily. I don't know if they've stopped during the daily press updates now, but, you know, he'd been providing information about the hurricane and the damage and the response. And so very much, you know, the reason we elect a governor in the state of North Carolina is to do things like this, Republican or Democrat. And so he's very much had to be a governor over the last few weeks. And I think that's shown through.
Our guest, Nick Oxner with WBTV in Charlotte. And Nick, the good and the bad about politics kind of come and go as the ebb and flow throughout the campaign season. Recently, we've seen some of the bad. Over the weekend in Orange County, a firebomb lobbed into the GOP headquarters, and then the other violence in Pamlico County. This is certainly not the norm, and it's very disconcerting.
Yeah, I think disconcerting is right, and also not the norm is right. And I think that's why you've seen such an outsized response, you know, to that from Republicans, from Democrats, from people in North Carolina, people outside of North Carolina. I think it has been reassuring to see the response to this from all across the spectrum, from across, you know, areas, from across, you know, sectors of parties and groups. You know, everyone seems to say this is not something that we can tolerate, and I hope, you know, people are sincere as they say that, because you know, as a journalist, obviously we rely on the First Amendment and freedoms to have thought and expression every day, and that's, you know, to some degree, the same rights that people working on political campaigns and political headquarters are relying upon. And so I think it's very important that we, you know, maintain a society where those things are respected, protected.
Absolutely. I would concur with you on that 100%. Now, in terms of some of the stuff that you've been working on, we wanted to get an update from you. I know that you've done some really excellent work in exposing outrageous wait times at the Salisbury VA Medical Center there. Is there anything new to report?
Nothing new exactly. In fact, you know, the director at the Salisbury VA, a couple days after the inspector general released its report, you know, that about the wait times, the director at the Salisbury VA called that old news and kind of tried to dismiss it, said that they'd corrected all their problems. Of course, she'd also told the inspector general's folks at the time that they had fixed their problems, you know, when they were just starting their investigation that uncovered this. So it's hard to believe what's accurate and what's not in terms of when she says that everything's fine, because she said that before and it wasn't.
Yeah, well, we appreciate it. I know the veterans do the work that you're doing there. Kind of makes the work of being in the media, you know, feel a little better, because sometimes, you know, the things that we cover and write about and report on are just things and they're news, but this is something that I know has real solid help attached to it for those who are serving our country.
And that's why we're so committed to it. I mean, I absolutely am committed to helping our veterans, our station, my managers, you know, my coworkers are all committed to that. And so, you know, I got in to be a reporter to help people, and this is one way that we can certainly do that.
Our guest, Nick Oxner with WBTV in Charlotte. Now, what are you hearing, Nick, about the political campaigns that are going on in the state right now? Civitas releasing polls yesterday that I would just summarize as saying every race looks pretty close. Is that what you're hearing? You know, it's really scientific.
Throw your hands up.
Yeah.
Pass the coin, and that's what's going to happen. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, I think it was all an internet-based poll that came out a couple days ago that showed Roy Cooper with like a 13-point lead over Pat McCrory. And the, obviously the Cooper folks touting that because it makes their guy look good. But, you know, I think we've seen a couple polls come out now, the Civitas poll, the SurveyUSA poll, all has the race, you know, within a couple points, one way or the other. And all of that, of course, within your margin of error. And so really what that tells me is this thing is a dead heat, and it's probably going to keep being a dead heat in all the way until Election Day, which is part of the people who find politics to be fun. This is the part that they think is fun.
Yeah, exactly. People who are weird like me that enjoy watching these things. So in terms of the noise, now that the presidential debate is over and it doesn't look like the McCrory and Cooper are going to have another debate, and of course I can't forget Mr. Cecil, who we're glad talked about medical cannabis in the debate. But in terms of the noise from those races, in particular for the down ballot folks, do you think the next couple of weeks is going to give them a good opportunity to get their messages out, or is it still going to be dominated by the Trump and Hillary and McCrory Cooper campaigns?
You know, that's actually a really interesting question, because I think we're finally starting to see, you know, state house races go up on TV. We're starting to see some additional buys that are linked to the race for the Bob Edmonds, Justice Bob Edmonds seat on the Supreme Court. You know, he's running for re-election and has a challenger. And so we're starting to see that. We're getting late enough, close enough to the election day that it's time for them. You know, obviously they don't have the hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to spend on TV advertising like other, you know, like the top of the ticket races. Frankly, I think that we will see the most new noise coming from the U.S. Senate race between Richard Burr and Deborah Ross, because even though that's the top of the ticket race, it's really something that's kind of laid low, I think, as a reporter covering politics for the last, you know, it seems like last eternity. You know, we've been focusing on the presidential race, we've been focusing on the gubernatorial race, and it's allowed the Burr-Ross race to kind of fly under the radar comparatively. I think that both those campaigns are starting to make more noise. I've been paying more attention to them. We did a fact check 2 weeks ago on Richard Burr and a fact check last week on Deborah Ross's record, supporting or opposing, depending on who you believe, the sex offender registry. And I think we're going to continue to see the rhetoric ramp up in that race.
Well, our guest, Nick Oxner, here with WBTV. It's interesting because so much of what we hear, even in these debates, from both sides is inaccurate, you know, and the words fact checker and fact check and go to my website and all that have become part of the daily vernacular, it seems. One thing that was a fact that perhaps Roy Cooper didn't know about in the debate that he had with the governor was the fact that the FBI had concluded their investigation and had not found anything amiss, so to speak, with the prison contract issue. Is it unusual that the state attorney general wasn't aware of that, do you think, or do you think he was aware of it and was just trying to score points?
No. I think that the most likely scenario is he wasn't aware. It's not outside the realm of possible. It is what I think is the most likely and always assume is that federal investigators and federal prosecutors don't want to talk about what they're doing to anyone ever.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, what they're doing and who they're doing it to is really kept very close unless they were to bring charges against somebody. In fact, I think I was kind of shocked to see that the U.S. Attorney's Office was willing to put out a statement that they had closed their investigation.
Yeah.
And of course, that only came out after, you know, the allegations from Cooper, the remarks from Cooper about McCrory being under investigation by the FBI. But the fact of the matter is that, of course, that investigation's been closed. I highly doubt that Roy Cooper knew that it had been closed. Because that's just not something that the FBI would tell the state attorney general.
One last question, Nick. Big headline on your website, WBTV.com. The early voting starts today. And as a television station, I'm sure that you are aware of all of these allegations that are being tossed around about voter integrity and that sort of thing. Are you guys going to keep an eye on the early voting and kind of monitor what's going on and be on the lookout, so to speak, for things that may be newsworthy as far as, whether or not those types of things are happening?
We are going to keep an eye on it because I think that's part of our job is watchdogs. It's certainly the role that we play as media and that I try to play as an investigative reporter. And to the extent that that's happening, I don't know that we've heard any specific cases yet, although we're only, 8 hours, less than that, 6 hours into voting. That's certainly something that we want to know about. And if folks bring credible claims from around our area, we certainly want to investigate it. Of course, the State Board of Elections has made every assurance that they're taking all the steps they can to make sure that our process is above reproach. And Kim Strack, as the director of the Board of Elections, I think takes her job very seriously. So I think we'll go from there.
And finally, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Tim Kaine, vice presidential candidate, going to be in town. Are you going to pop a few with him at the brewery?
I need a few drinks just to get through the last couple of weeks of this election.
Exactly.
No, one of my colleagues is covering him today, but I'll say this. It's interesting that, and it really says a lot, that the Clinton campaign is sending him to spend so much time here in North Carolina, and particularly, obviously, his visit today and yesterday is time to get people motivated to go vote early. And the Clinton campaign has really made it no secret that they're trying to drive people to the polls in early voting. And so I think this is just another thing that underscores that fact.
Yeah, and of course, the Trump folks have been here as well. I think he's coming to Asheville on Friday, tomorrow. So North Carolina...
Everyone's been everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really really highlights, Nick. Our state is pretty important, I guess.
It is. I mean, this is probably the battleground. And it's interesting because in 2008, this time in 2008, the McCain campaign was starting to realize that they were probably going to lose North Carolina. And they'd kind of written North Carolina off because they thought they were going to win it. And so all of a sudden, early to mid-October, they kind of said, oh, crap. And so we saw Senator McCain and Governor Palin here in the state a lot. We were contested in 12, right? But I think nothing like what we've seen this year. So it's been interesting.
Well, thank you for all that you do to cover not only political stuff, but everything that you cover. You certainly are without peer in that realm of investigative reporting in North Carolina, and we thank you so much for being our guest.
Great. Thanks, Mark.
All right. Thanks, Nick. We look forward on Thursdays to talking with our good friend Bob Lipke, Dr. Bob Lipke, here at the Civitas Institute, and he's the education policy analyst, or as I like to affectionately say, education czar. But anyway, Bob, welcome back.
Good to be here, Mark.
Now, we've been talking off and on for quite some time about education, which, of course, you are really have your finger on the pulse of what's going on in North Carolina, like very few other people do. And I ran across a headline yesterday from an article that was published on October 18th in the Charlotte Observer. Exam, only one CMS high school has a majority ready for college. And I thought, well, this is something that I've got to talk to Bob about.
Yeah, it did catch your eye, didn't it, as I thought it caught most people's eyes. It was a stunning headline. People talk about things, how badly things are going in schools, and a few times do we get actually an arresting headline that kind of lays out the scope of the wreckage in a lot of places.
Bob, you have this interesting dynamic going on. Folks on the left, they're clamoring for more money for teachers, for schools. We hear that, teachers are leaving the state in droves, which is certainly something that is not true. But how can the people over at DPI and the school board and others see a headline like that and look themselves in the mirror and take themselves seriously?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them that question. I have no idea. What this really gets down to, in my view, is I think people should really be angry when they see something like that. Because once you get past the shock and the numbing detail that's in the data in this, and you can access all these scores online, on the Department of Public Instruction's website. I'm not going to go into the details here, but if anybody wants it, we could put up the link on the blog or
sure.
whatever. But once you get past this, the wreckage, the disappointment, et cetera, I mean, you got to ask questions about accountability. You have to, because we've been trying, you know, all these different things. I mean, education is so subject to what the latest fad is. And, you know, early in the 2000s, we had No Child Left Behind, and that
right.
race to the top and Common Core and all this stuff. All children were supposed to be proficient in the math and reading by 2013-14. Did that happen?
No.
No. None of this stuff happens. And you look at something like this, and you see not only that our kids are not performing at all at the level that they should be, but you also find out by implication kids keep getting passed along from grade to grade to grade. And that's not acceptable. It's simply not acceptable. And this problem then becomes a problem in college, which then becomes a problem in the workforce. And my question is, where's the accountability?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And, you know, and obviously you can't, you know, answer how do these people look at themselves in the mirror, but it's kind of a rhetorical question because people see a
headline.
Well,
it's not a rhetorical question in the sense that if you go on the State Board of Education's website, you have their state goals on there. You have what the kids are supposed to be able to graduate. All children should be graduating. Should graduate. And one of the goals is college readiness.
Yep.
Which is exactly what the ACT exam measures. So in this article, it says that about approximately 20% of the students in CMS in Charlotte Mecklenburg School District hit all four benchmarks. Statewide, that's better than statewide, which was approximately, I think, 15%.
Good grief.
So that should send off alarms.
Absolutely.
So 15 out of every 100 kids that are graduating. Now, these tests are taken in 11th grade. And North Carolina is one of 9 states, I believe, that tests all 11th graders. Now, anybody who knows about the ACT... historically, it hasn't been, states have not, it's been an optional exam.
Right.
College, kids that are going to go to college, oftentimes more elite schools, would take the test, and they were inherently better students. After North Carolina had required all 11th graders to take the exam, the scores dropped, understandably. But, you know, that was 2012, 2013, when the state required it. We've had 3 years now of what we're hoping would be progress to get the scores up, and that hasn't happened.
Yeah, our guest, Dr. Bob Lipke with the Civitas Institute, talking about this glaring Charlotte Observer headline, only one Charlotte Mecklenburg School District high school has a majority of students ready for college. This is based on test results from the ACT test, and the opening sentence says 20% of juniors in Charlotte Mecklenburg schools earned ACT scores last spring that show they're ready to be successful in key college courses. Now, you just pointed out, and they have also this figure here in big, bold, blue letters, 99,100 students, North Carolina juniors, took the ACT in 2015, and only 15.4% had college-ready scores. Obviously, Bob, if they've gone through 11 years or whatever it is to be a junior, that senior year, it's unlikely that they're going to be able to suddenly make up whatever it is they're deficient in to be college ready. And so the question, and I think you alluded to it, is what's going on in the system where year after year students are promoted to the next grade, but here they are as juniors, not proficient in stuff that should be fairly basic by then.
You just answered the question. That's what's going on.
But how? I mean,
you know, well, obviously we are not holding kids to the standards that we say we are. We're just simply not doing it.
Yeah.
It's no more complicated than that. Now, you can get into why, and there's exceptions that principals can make, and we're going to have several discussions on why kids get passed on, but the fact of the matter is we're passing the problems along from grade to grade, and they rear their heads. The problem rears its head, you know, in something like this. This is really a bad sign.
So you say we are allowing this to happen, and I don't think that you mean you and me, although I'm certainly willing to take the blame. But here's my question.
When I say we, I'm serious about that.
But who are you specifically returning to? Is it parents?
Well, there's 115 school districts.
Is it the General Assembly?
Well, we can have a long discussion on that. The funding, 65% of all school funding comes from the state.
Right.
Approximately that. The remainder, 35%, comes from most of that 35%, the remaining 35% comes from local and the feds. Most of the policies and most of what happens at local schools is pretty much directed in large part by local school boards. And those people are locally elected.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that state policies don't significantly impact what goes on at the local level. It does. But as far as accountability, if parents are up in arms about scores, as they should be, and I would imagine that parents have seen, I mean, this article that we're talking about CMS.
Yeah.
And that there should be a fair amount of energy in the air, you know, at the next CMS school board meeting, because that's what's supposed to happen. I mean, there should be answers to these questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe parents don't really know, because my wife and I raised two kids that went through the public school system here in North Carolina, and, you know, they would bring home report cards every quarter. And, you know, they would have A's and whatever, occasional B. But we didn't have any thought or notion that they weren't learning or being prepared for college. And maybe parents really don't know.
Well, I think too many parents have unwittingly dumped their children off at the school door and said, essentially, here's my child, educate them.
Right.
Parents have a responsibility to participate and really guide that process. You know your child better than anyone else, and you need to take a real active role in that effort. And I think when they do, children's education, it's enhanced, and it turns out much better than just expecting that teachers are the experts, that they're going to know all the answers, because they don't either. And many of them do a good job, yes,
sure,
but not all children are the same. We all know that.
Is this, though, Bob, I mean, is it like a vicious circle? Because if members who are elected to the General Assembly or to local school boards suddenly announce, okay, we're done with this system, we're going to restructure, we're going to reallocate money, maybe even cut money in some cases. In other words, if they were really to try to implement radical reform that was genuinely targeted towards helping kids, probably the vast majority of them would not get reelected. And they know that. And that fear keeps anything from significant being implemented.
I agree with you in part. That's an issue, and obviously in certain districts and so forth, but I actually believe it's also a plus in many districts because parents are fed up. I mean, this whole sentiment that we're talking about has been roiling in North Carolina for the last decade.
Yeah.
You know, it's what's fueled the charter school movement. Mm-hmm. It's what's fueled school choice movement.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, those are obviously still moving strong, and that sentiment is, it's strong and growing.
Yeah. So we can talk about it, and we can conclude our interview and come back in 2 weeks and talk about it again. But you and I talking about it is, it's a good thing. I always enjoy our conversations. But how do we move from talking about it and from writing big glaring headlines that talk about kids not being ready? If there were one thing you could do today, whether it be at the General Assembly or at local school boards or with parents, what would you do today to start improving this situation in North Carolina?
Well, I don't have kids that are school age anymore.
Right.
But when I go out and talk, I encourage parents to get involved in their child's education. Get to know their teachers. Know what their kids are learning. Be active in that process. Don't assume that it's the public school's responsibility, or it's, you know, even if it's at a private school.
Yeah.
You know, that it's the school's responsibility to educate your child. Know what's going on. That'll help you. That'll help the child. It also will improve accountability.
Yeah.
Because that's what we're talking about. Right now, we have a system that's not working. We've tried a million things. We're flailing in many senses, you know, at different options and so forth. And I think, you know, in large part, we're trying to fight our way out of this. And
yeah,
we've done it unsuccessfully.
Well, I think that's an excellent, excellent first step, is to encourage parents to become more involved and active in their kids' education. Very well stated. And, you know, Bob, the show is what matters in North Carolina. And right now, education aside, I think that the problems that Aaron Rodgers is having throwing the ball for the Packers is certainly something that matters to me, and I know it matters to you too.
Yeah, so we don't have enough time to discuss that topic.
But on a positive note, the Cubs did win last night, so there's still hope.
Yes, the Cubs won. The Cubs won. The sun came up.
It did. So, Bob, Dr. Bob Lipke of Civitas Institute, as always, thank you very much for joining us here on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, Bob trying to do a little Harry Carey imitation there, and enjoy talking with Bob Lipke about all things having to do with education in North Carolina. He certainly is expert in that arena, and we appreciate him sharing that expertise with us here on the program. Well, we've had a great show today. We appreciate Nick Oxner of WBTV and all that he is working on, getting us up to date there. We also appreciate Representative Nelson Dollar from the North Carolina House of Representatives, and just affirming that they really had to come in 2011 and face a $3 billion budget shortfall and other issues where the state government was in disarray from the previous majority, which was the Democrats in the North Carolina General Assembly for decades. And they fixed stuff. They did it in fine fashion, and they did it quickly. That is what is so remarkable to me. If you can remember, folks, the General Assembly has only been under conservative majority for a couple of years, 6 years. And in that time, they've done amazing things by cutting taxes, reforming the unemployment program, and it's just amazing where our state is compared to where it was. And would you do me a favor? Would you help get this message out? Tell people to listen to our segment with Nelson Dollar today. Go to freedomactionnetwork.com. and download the show. You can also find it in iTunes and Google Play. In fact, just subscribe to the program. Get your friends and family to do so. Because a lot of people in North Carolina, apparently, they just don't know the amazing turnaround that has happened and how our economy in the state literally is surging. The media, the mainstream folks, won't tell you. So you need to get the facts and get them here as often as you can. We appreciate you listening. Tomorrow, we will also have another great lineup for you, and we are excited about that. And as always, we don't take you for granted. Thank you very much for listening to the program. We appreciate you being a part of What Matters in North Carolina. Until tomorrow, bye.